Last week, we had a discussion in the round. And from that discussion, we have some notes. The notes are attached to the back of this Conrad Lorenz piece. And I think Vladimir would be willing to give you a copy of the DVD from last week if you weren't here, and also from the previous week, which was the culmination of the Darwin to philosophy transition. So I think both of the last 2 weeks have been pretty interesting developments. We'll see tonight. What I'm proposing to do tonight is focus specifically on the work of one mind. And this focus follows the discussion that comes at the end of last week's sharing. These questions, or these attempts to answer that question, are very much along the lines of Conrad Lorenz's explorations. And I think just for the sake of our own repertoire of understanding, it's worthwhile to review his work. It's quite significant. And yet, it's right at the bottom of the hierarchy that Vladimir was just speaking about. It goes all the way back to the physical. But it addresses very, very thoroughly this question that Mira raised last time about the presence of consciousness and the foundation of consciousness in lower forms of life. I didn't say lower forms of consciousness. And so Lorenz did a very good job, I think, of putting the higher ranges of human understanding back in touch with the lower forms of life and finding the origins of consciousness in matter. And that, you know, is very much the project of our age. From Nietzsche on to Bergson and Sri Aurobindo and the physicists, the project is really very much a project of putting consciousness back into matter, reconnecting consciousness with its origins. And the philosophical project, as I mentioned both of the last 2 weeks, has been the definition of the frame. Human understanding is abstract, and now we know everything. But all of that which we know is actually a frame of what is. a pictographic frame or a verbal frame or a systematic frame. And so what has been learned through the last 100 years about consciousness is basically that it is not the frame. But what we know is the frame. And so when Heidegger declared the end of philosophy, he was addressing this idea that now everything has been reduced to the reserve of energy, the reserve of consciousness, the virtualization of existence is complete. And it is a very destructive culmination. Technology is the culmination of this mental development. And everything is reduced to the formulas of technology. And so we know everything. We know what it is, where it is, how much is there, what can be done with it, what the potentials are, where it came from, where it fits with everything else. We know now in terms of this abstract, formulaic knowledge. And it amounts to a crisis. And so philosophy, the project of philosophy has in the 20th century, from Bergson to the present, following Nietzsche's inspiration, has been to define this frame and its limits, the limitations of this human understanding, and the importance of turning it all upside down and reconnecting with the experiential reality. So Lorenz goes in very far in this direction and begins to discover the roots of consciousness in the simplest structures. And he declares that all of evolution is a process of learning, that cognition is the basic process of evolution. And he demonstrates it quite well. And he brings us up to the frame also, and then we can ask the question again. But in this summary, if this were a regular class, a regular university class, everyone here would expect to be expected to produce something. And so all of these questions that we put up last time could constitute themes for papers that you would research and present to the rest of us. And then you would really learn something. We don't have that expectation here. Which shows in a way the primitive nature of our university project. We're in the sort of the religious, earlier religious mode, you know, where people aren't expected to actually learn anything. They're just supposed to copy what they're told by the authorities. So I'm the priest, I'm giving you the word of the authorities, and you're supposed to get enlightenment from it. Of course, we all know that that doesn't work, and maybe we will find a different mode at some point. So you have the option, you have the outline, and you have the option to do your own research in all of these areas that you asked about. Those questions all came from this group. So that means there are some questions there that people have. And we will learn from Conrad Lorenz that Vladimir was explaining to us earlier this afternoon is really the way that we learn to use language meaningfully. It's called exploratory behavior. When you're in front of something that you don't really understand fully, you explore it. You chew on it, you kick it around, you paw at it, and you try to eat it, and you figure out something about it, and it's play. The most sophisticated philosophical mind in the world, who recently died, unfortunately, at not too old of an age, I think he was 75 or so, Jacques Derrida, said that the real human function is play. Our highest resource, our way to be most fully is to play. And learning is play, and literature is play, and philosophy is play, and art is play, and theater is play, and life is play. And so Lorenz shows us that one of the important transitions that took place in animal evolution was that sort of stereotypical behaviors which were originally for a purpose related to survival began to be used for the purpose of play. And so a whole series of behaviors that you can observe in an animal under normal survival conditions, you can observe all together at one time in a play situation. The animal will go through all of its inherited and perfected behaviors that it uses in the wild within a few minutes of play. Not for the purpose of any of those, what any of those behaviors were meant for originally, but just for the purpose of learning, experiencing. So I'm going to then move to Conrad Lorenz here and read through some things. Well, the whole theory of constructivist education comes from this understanding. Lorenz called his field ethology, and the root is the Greek word ethos. And ethos means a habit or a way of being, a recognizable form of a people or a person or a society. Its ethos is its characteristic behavior. So what Lorenz did was study the characteristic behaviors of thousands of species and compared them and analyzed them. And so ethology is what he called his science. And the first concept here is the root concept that Bergson also spoke about in the handout that I gave you. The world of objects, the material world of our experience, only takes shape through our eliminating the subjective and the contingent. What causes us to believe in the reality of things is, in the last analysis, the constancy with which certain external impressions recur in our experience, always simultaneously and always in the same pattern, irrespective of variations in general conditions. Contingent or subjective influences, if we think about the whole process of categorizing phyla and classes and orders and genera and so on, what is necessary for us to do is to reduce them to their common characteristics and to eliminate all of the contingencies of their existence. A contingency is something that happens but doesn't affect anything essential. Whether or not the animal appears at the lakeside at 6 o'clock this evening or not has nothing to do with the fact that the animal appears at the lakeside regularly. And so after observing a series of phenomena, we eliminate all of the what Aristotle called accidents, and we retain that which is constant. And this, he describes, this activity of abstracting constant properties, he describes with the verb objectivating, and its achievement by the noun objectivation. Now, this is obviously something that's done by the mind. It is an abstract linguistic activity of the mind. And this is problematic in the end, because once we have done that, we no longer have the thing itself. Our experience of the thing itself is a direct contact. And our nervous system receives the vibrations of the thing itself and returns vibrations to the thing itself and enters into a ground of experience from which impressions are gathered, which are abstracted as knowledge, concepts. So this is a process that Lawrence explores in great detail. The scientist sees man as a creature who owes his qualities and functions, including his highly developed powers of cognition, to evolution. Any adaptation to a particular circumstance of external reality presupposes that a measure of information about that circumstance has already been absorbed. So he starts with a gastropod, for example, a snail, and he analyzes how this snail wrinkles itself up and stretches itself out in which directions in order to move in which direction. And he comes to the conclusion that the snail receives input, heat, moisture, changes in the environment, which shift the surface tension and enable the snail to move in a certain direction. And in that moment, he concludes that the snail has processed information about the environment. And so the idea that consciousness, our consciousness, evolves from the earliest one-celled organisms is based upon the idea that the earliest one-celled organisms, through their level of consciousness, enabled the next level of consciousness to emerge. And so on and so on through 3 billion years. Each big change he calls a fulguratio, a lightning flash. The major changes he calls lightning flashes, and he will show how the human being emerges as a result of synthesizing many different streams of development that were undertaken by different species. But all of these experiments of evolution achieved relationships in the whole field, and everything that exists learned from all of those relationships. And then at some point there was a synthesis, which each aspect of which can be traced back to some line of consciousness that had evolved in some or other species already. Similarly, anatomical development, morphogeny, the forms of things, produces in the organic system actual images of the outside world. Even the slipper animalcule, paramecium, which, when it meets an obstacle, first recoils slightly, then swims on again in a random direction, knows something, quite literally objective, about its environment. Everything we know about the material world derives from our phylogenetically evolved mechanisms for acquiring information. Mechanisms infinitely more complex than those which elicit the avoidance response of the paramecium. The method of the genome, which we have read plenty about, the chemical, biochemical level of species, which evolves, perpetually making experiments, matching their results against reality, and retaining what is fittest, differs from that adopted by man in his scientific quest for knowledge in only one respect, and that not a vital one. Namely, that the genome learns only from its successes, whereas man learns also from his failures. the acquisition and storage of relevant information is as basic a function of all living organisms as is the absorption and storing of energy. Life is an eminently active enterprise aimed at acquiring both a fund of energy and a stock of knowledge. The possession of one being instrumental to the acquisition of the other. And so animals are, the behavior of animals is primarily for the sake of storing energy. But in order to do it, the animal is learning from its environment. And when it learns, it succeeds. What it learns, it passes on genetically because it reproduces its kind. And if the next generation has a better understanding, a more perfect sensitivity, a longer neck, then it learns something that its progenitor didn't know, and it survives a little bit better, and it reproduces itself more successfully than its progenitor. And so at this completely unconscious level, in terms of what we call consciousness, cognition is going on at the phylogenetic level, at the morphogenetic level, at the physical vital level. Cognition is going on. So Lauren says, it strikes me as a matter of course that we should investigate both the objective physiological processes which provide men with information about the external world, meaning human beings, and the subjective events of our own experience and knowledge. Our conviction of the unity of man as a physical entity, the human being, and an experiencing subject, soul, entitles us to draw our knowledge both from physiology and from phenomenology. An investigation of this kind must needs pursue a double aim. On the one hand, it seeks to formulate a theory of human knowledge based on biological and phylogenetic information, and on the other, to produce a picture of the human being which matches this theory of knowledge. This means making the human mind an object of scientific investigation. So that is what we are doing, and that is what Sri Aurobindo said would be one of the two ways for human beings to discover that consciousness and force are the essential principles of existence. Either by a scientific study of the human mind equal to the scientific study of living things, or by an intuitive approach. Either way, he said, could bring the human being to an understanding that consciousness and energy are the same. the scientific mind is pursuing that understanding scientifically by observing nature. The intuitive mind is pursuing it from the top down, reconnecting with the universal consciousness force at the top. Either way, said Sri Aurobindo, can arrive there. This is the scientific approach. The physiological roots of conceptual thought. I think this is extremely important to be aware of. And it's not something that we see with our eyes. It requires a considerable amount of study and analysis. What are sensory and nervous mechanisms, optical or auditory, convey to us is invariably the product of highly complex, if totally unconscious, computations which seek to abstract from the chaos of accidental sensory data those data which are constantly inherent in that transsubjective reality which we realists assume lies behind sense data. The essential function of this unconscious reasoning. Lies in establishing a correlation or a constellation of certain stimulus data which remain constant in time. The sensory system itself selects from experience, learns from experience, what happens when it gets this close to that temperature. And after a while, it doesn't go that way anymore. After a certain number of constant experiences, it learns not to go that way. It learns when that odor hits the receptors, the afferent nervous system sends the response to keep going in that direction because it has learned that that's where the ripe bananas are. And so the physical has incorporated through species and millennia patterns of behavior that it has learned, that they have learned. And these behaviors are part of the complex, the physical, vital, mental complex. The mind is working in the physical and in the vital for survival through billions of years. This has always been known by the human mind. It was a very early understanding. But to substantiate it with certainty has been an obsession for at least 2,500 years of the human species. The intuition was there. Aristotle had it, and surely those before him had it even better than him, because he was already falling into the logical certainty trap. But now that we can observe species with electron microscopes and subject them to all kinds of experiments, we can find out how fast they learn and under what circumstances they learn. We can teach paramecia and rats and chimpanzees to do things. As has been demonstrated, the visual cells on the frog's retina are united into separate groups and send their afferent neurites, afferent means nerve tissue, to one ganglion cell. The latter responds selectively to messages from the group as a whole. Each aspect of the group sends a slightly different impulse, and the ganglion sort it out and arrive at the nature of the origin of that impression. One gives a signal when a dark shape passes across the retina from left to right. Another when its cells register an increase or a decrease in illumination. There are even ganglia which respond only when a convex area of shadow moves in a particular direction. In the strict physiological sense, the actual stimulus is simply the light that falls on a rod or cone cell. That a convex area of shadow is moving across the retina from left to right, probably an insect, not too far away for the jump, is a message transmitted by a highly complex neurosensory mechanism which responds to a pattern of individual stimuli. The frog jumps and catches the fly and knows exactly the distance. So these kinds of recognizable patterns of behavior, Lorenz coined the term key stimulus for. It's not just any kind of stimulus and response behavioristic concept, but it's a concept of patterns of stimuli and response that are regular features of the behavior of an organism or a species. A great deal of our knowledge rests on the principle of pattern matching. But our perception of patterns involves a process which is the equivalent of abstraction. For if messages from the visual cells in the frog's retina combine to provide information of the kind mentioned above, and if this process functions independently of the absolute size of the stimuli, we are dealing solely with relationships and configurations, with abstractions. What is abstracted in this way are properties constantly inherent in the object. This kind of perception we call constancy phenomena. So this constancy phenomena, such as color, color constancy and form constancy, have different causal origins, yet all serve the purpose of enabling us to identify the objects around us as being the same. So in philosophy, in the 20th century, one set of concepts that has been explored repeatedly because it is the fundamental characteristic of knowing, of the way the human mind functions, is the concept of identity and difference. We know things spontaneously in terms of their sameness and their difference. And our tendency, just like the tendency of the frog, is to eliminate the difference and to focus on that which is the identity, and to give it a name, and to give it a category, and to give it the status of a law, if it's a recurrent behavior. We arrive at the concept of law and generality in the same way as the frog arrives morphogenetically at its survival behavior. And we are not conscious of that, those extremely complex underlying transfers of energy that are happening in ourselves that enable us to suddenly perceive the identity between 5,000 words written by Martin Heidegger and 5,000 words written by Sri Aurobindo and 5,000 words written by Henri Bergson. But it jumps out at us, the identities of their concepts and the differences of their expressions are processed by us in a kind of subtle audio-visual pattern that is the product of a billion years of evolution. And we don't know how it happens, we just know that we suddenly become aware of it. And it corresponds to what's there because we can check it out with each other. And sure enough, we all process it more or less the same way. Some a little faster and some a little more slowly, perhaps, but depending on training. And this is an example of the leaps which happen. There are innumerable anecdotes like this. It once happened that a calculating machine originally designed to work out compound interest, surprised its inventors by showing a capacity to handle integral and differential calculus as well. Something similar is involved with constancy mechanisms of perception, which were developed under the selection pressure of the need to infallibly identify particular objects in the environment. Surprisingly, these same physiological mechanisms are also able to isolate the characteristics not just of one single object, but of a whole class of objects, ignoring variable contingent features found only in individual cases and identifying the basic constant gestalt of class. And that's exactly what we do when we perform complex mathematical operations or write philosophical tracts. It is coming up. Let's see if he can make it known to us. This supreme function of constancy mechanism, you know what that means now, right? Constancy mechanism means that somehow your cells, your nervous system, is able to tell you what's red every time it sees it. is quite independent of rational abstraction. It is equally proper to higher animals as it is to small children. All these functions of abstraction and objectivation performed by gestalt perception. It means that you recognize a complex field of stimuli for what it is, without all the unnecessary details. So in psychology, when you observe the behaviors of a certain pathology in a patient over a long period of time, you eventually come to an understanding of that behavior, which is that behavior under all of its different impulses and deprivations and idiosyncrasies. And after, you know, suddenly you get it, and you get the root of it, and you get the idea of how to treat it, and you somehow know the whole without any of its extra unnecessary distractions which have preoccupied you throughout many sessions of analysis.
I'd like to suggest that another mechanism that happens in that moment where the doctor knows the illness that the patient has, that his projection of that illness onto the patient encourages the patient to get the illness.
Could happen. You're a real skeptic, aren't you?
It's that thing where we produce the reality in front of us, which reflects back the reality that we already know, which may not be the whole reality altogether.
But that's not what he's speaking about. What he's speaking about is when the thing itself reveals itself to you as a result of frequent observation. And he's tracing this phenomenon back to very simple organic behaviors where nobody can impose any preconceptions, because the animal deals only with the object. And what eventually becomes clear is that the human being can generalize without the presence of an object. And this, he says, is the sole difference between the way the human being functions abstractly and the way the animal functions abstractly. The animal always needs an object present to make an association. The human being doesn't need to have an object present. And therefore, it's possible to transmit knowledge to others, which they can then apply in a situation when it arises, without having already seen that situation. This animals do not do, according to what we can observe. They can behave with knowledge based upon the experience of an object when that object is in the field of experience, and their characteristic behavior is stimulated, which is learned through experience. Whereas human culture has taken this fundamental physiological function of the mind and leaped into this plane of pure mental abstraction, where, based upon experience, we can keep an object in our consciousness for a very long period of time, even a lifetime, and continually develop that object, which is now a mental object, that becomes a cultural artifact. And that cultural artifact conveys to others who haven't had our experience quite a lot of information. The attempt here is to draw parallels between these. Perception, by which he means sight and hearing, primarily, and touch. Perception, even, appears to possess its own mechanism for storing information. I have described in detail how the process by which a gestalt or form crystallizes, emerging against a background of contingent elements, may extend over very long periods, sometimes many years. Ethologists and doctors find time and again that a recurrent pattern of individual events, such as a succession of movements or a syndrome of pathological symptoms, is only recognized as an invariable gestalt after sometimes thousands of observations. There can undoubtedly be mistakes made at that time also. What happens in such a case is remarkable enough. We obviously possess a mechanism that is capable of absorbing almost incredible numbers of individual observation records, of retaining them over long periods, and on top of all that, of evaluating them statistically. Now, evaluating them statistically is the rational abstract function, but observing them and storing them is not. At least this is a distinction that can be made not only in the human being, but at many levels. A system that can achieve this must be highly complex. Yet it is not surprising that in spite of their many similarities to rational actions, all these sensory and nervous processes take place in areas of our nervous system which are completely inaccessible to our consciousness and our self-observation. Ratiomorphous functions. That we're talking about subconscious selection processes, are independent of abstract thought and as old as the hills, like those which happen with the frog's sight. From the practical point of view, the perceptual functions of objectivation, that means storing an impression, and conceptualization, which means analyzing information, are the precursors of the corresponding functions of abstract thought. This would be primitive conceptualization. Understanding constancy are the precursors of the corresponding functions of abstract thought. And this answers a question which you asked a couple of times back. As is the case whenever pre-existing systems are integrated to form a higher unity, the former are by no means rendered superfluous by the sudden emergence of the latter, but constitute its precondition and its component parts. So the intuitive consciousness can't be performed or realized by the rational mind. The rational mind is something else, but the intuitive mind emerges from it. But it's a different function altogether. And so when that new function emerges, it implies new structures. It's not the rational mind anymore which is functioning. It has its own characteristic structures. But if those structures didn't exist, hadn't been evolved, then that those new structures could not emerge. This is the bottom-up perspective. This is the evolutionary perspective. This is not the involutionary perspective. And so in the Life Divine, which is going to be the focus of our last 4 weeks, Sri Aurobindo dwells upon this idea constantly, that the new consciousness cannot descend unless the higher mind is developed. But when it does descend, it's a completely different type of functioning. The ordinary rational functioning is still there, but it is altered and transformed and put in a different light because it's no longer the dominant power. But it doesn't go away. It can still be used. And so the mother can say, I left my mind behind a long time ago, but every week I'm sitting here with Satprim describing in perfectly logical terms my experiences. It sounds like a contradiction. But not necessarily. Okay, now we come to the human mind. Abstract thought, language, and culture. This is what we were discussing last week. What evidence is there that the human mind evolves? And so we began to explore what characterizes this human mind, what makes it different from other species' minds, and has it itself evolved in the last 5 or 10,000 or 50,000 years? Is there evidence of that? He says, it is only the development of abstract thought together with the complementary development of verbal language that enables tradition to become free of objects. For by means of independent symbols, facts and relationships can be established without the concrete presence of the objects themselves. Tradition, he explains, is a recognizable form of behavior in other species. Chimpanzees can communicate a tradition of tool use to their offspring if they're in the presence of what the tool needs to be used for and the material of the tool, and if all the circumstances come together in the right way, then the offspring can learn that under those conditions that can be done. But if a behavior like that is isolated, the next generation will not know it. It has to be a direct transmission. But it is a kind of early form of how what he defines as tradition, which is the passing on of the inheritance, actually, of acquired traits. The inheritance of acquired traits is what can't happen according to Darwinian evolutionary theory, but the thing that makes the difference between minds and other highly developed minds and other organisms is that we do pass on acquired traits through exposure, through example. Our behaviors don't depend upon genetic transmission. So if the transmission of a behavior to subsequent generations doesn't require genetic transmission, if it is not part of the physical vital complex, if it's a behavior, that is transmitted, if it is an understanding, a quality of understanding, an art, a science. These can be passed on through generations, traditionally, by culture. Animals do not do that.
But we can see also interesting what Moses, for example, did. How he brought this fight of moralistic behavior against our animal behavior. Right. Animal behavior is inherited.
So let us come to this, because this is where we were last time. The idea of the human being uniquely ethical, because we share tradition with animals. We share abstraction with animals. But there are some characteristics that we don't share. Language is one, in the way that we use it. So Lorenz identifies approximately eight different higher consciousness functions that exist in very low phylogenetic levels of evolution. The constancy function, which we've heard about, insight-controlled behavior directed to the survival purposive solutions of problems by means of the mechanisms that convey instantaneous information. So, on the spot, an animal can have insight into the situation in front of them and solve a problem. The most essential of these mechanisms are spatial orientation, of which among the higher vertebrates, the most important are those of sight. Mammals first survey the situation for some time in order to apprise themselves of the structural details of their surroundings, and then proceed to solve the problem posed by it at one stroke. This is very common animal behavior. Insight-controlled behavior. Voluntary movement. Animals can move voluntarily, not just by stimulus, but by choice. Not by external stimulus, but by choice. Perception of space and adaptability of motor activity are closely related. Well, the reason why animals perceive space is so that they can move in it. Exploratory behavior. Voluntary movement develops a new important function consisting in the feedback information on the spatial parameters by way of reafference. So the animal explores, plays, pokes around, gets information back, and decides what it's going to do about it. So exploratory behavior is common at all levels, practically, of life. As a tool of imitation, voluntary movement is a prerequisite of verbal speech and therewith for the higher evolution of abstract thought. And he uses Chomsky's examples of how language, which is similar among all subspecies of human beings, it follows the same structures. And he uses the example of Helen Keller, who learned without any knowledge of language, all about language. The idea that these processes of abstract thought, which go on the cellular level for the purpose of assessing, evaluating, choosing, surviving, this voluntary movement and abstract thinking, which is going on at the cellular level, as Chomsky says, constitutes the pre-existing structure of language. So when language starts to be used, it is spatial, and it is used basically in all cultures in the same way with respect to space. Verbs and nouns and prepositions and what we do before and after and where we go, and so most of our basic language patterns are logical linguistic patterns and not just linguistic patterns. They're not separated from our fundamental logical functioning processes, at least in an early kind of primitive usage. Imitation is, strictly speaking, not an independent cognitive process. In man, the act of imitation appears to be initiated by kinesthetic processes. Both humans and birds have an urge to imitate sounds, and they follow this urge for its own sake, without concern for its purpose. Many human beings do that. It's more fun than using it for a purpose. It's called chatting. Yeah? Okay, now we get to transmission of tradition. The transmission of individually acquired knowledge from one generation to the next is known as tradition. Individually acquired knowledge. Birds and lower mammals sometimes pass on knowledge of a particular object in this way, while apes can even hand down certain techniques. In all these cases, the transmission of knowledge is dependent on the presence of the object. Only with the evolution of abstract thought and human language does tradition, through the creation of free symbols, become independent of the object. This independence is the prerequisite of the accumulation of supra-individual knowledge and its transmission over long periods, an achievement of which only man is capable. Now, the question of cultural invariance and how cultures transmit knowledge, human cultures, is our question. Is the human mind evolving? Or are all of these cultures more or less the same? And do we just keep doing the same things in more or less the same ways from age to age and culture to culture? One of the images that Lawrence uses is the image of the phyletic tree, where if you look at all the animals at the top of the tree, you don't necessarily conclude that they have a common origin. If you look at all the different cultures that have existed in history, their artifacts, their languages, their religions, their behaviors, their economic structures, they are very unique in their expressions of all of these things, even though they share similar patterns. You don't get the idea that one developed from the other. You get the idea that they all developed independently, and that's pretty much the case. The great early civilizations that we know of developed quite independently. So, what happens culturally from age to age, not from culture to culture, but from age to age in the development of a culture? Do they all evolve in similar ways? This can be studied and has been studied. This is what Gebser has done. And actually, in the next 4 weeks, we'll look at both Gebser and Sri Aurobindo. But the function of culture is this transmission of acquired knowledge, which enables cultures to evolve. And yes, they have all evolved. And this is how they did it. Knowledge cannot be stored in any other form than in structure, whether this be the chain molecules of the ganglion cells of the brain or the letters in a textbook. Structure is adaptation in its finished form. But if further adaptation is to take place and fresh knowledge is to be acquired, a structure must be dismantled and rebuilt, at least in part. All accumulation of human knowledge as a necessary constituent of cultural being depends on the creation of firm structures. These structures need to possess a relatively high degree of invariance in order to become inheritable and to be passed down cumulatively over sustained periods of time. So, all of the cultures, all of the great cultures, have these structures which have been firm over long periods of time and have enabled everyone to acquire certain values, or at least they have expressed the values that everyone values significantly. Maybe not everyone values them, but they have held together the fabric of society for long periods of time. And they have undergone wars, they have undergone changes in climate, they've undergone migrations, but the cultures themselves have retained a consistency and a level of invariance. The sum total of information possessed by a culture residing in its habits and customs, that's ethology. Its methods of agriculture and technology, that's science. In the vocabulary and grammar of its language, and above all in its conscious, learned knowledge, and elsewhere he calls this ethical norms, ethical values, has to be stored in more or less rigid structures. But one must not forget that structure is adaptedness, not adaptation. Knowledge already possessed, not cognition. So here's an interesting definition of cognition. It is the act of apprehending. Not acquiring, not cognition. Adaptedness is not cognition, not acquiring knowledge. And as genetic constancy and variability, constancy on the one hand and variability on the other, identity and difference, have to strike a balance in the genome of an animal or plant so that it can survive, so also do the invariance and the adaptability of knowledge in a particular culture have to be in balance. So the culture has to have a certain amount of viability, flexibility, innovatability, if it's going to continue, but it has to have a kind of invariance which gives it consistency, just like in a species. Now, ritualization. This is the most interesting aspect of the whole thing. There's a large complex of behavior patterns, very diverse in origin but remarkably similar in function. which plays an important part in preserving the invariance of cultural tradition. And ritualized behavior is present in various animal species, such as in the dance of the bees and mating displays and pawing in the cat species and antler bashing in deer species, where the behavior is not being used for the purposes that it originally was created for, but it's being used as a demonstration to show that this one is the leader, or this one is only playing, or this one knows where it all is, but it's going to take time for everybody else to figure it out, so we're going to dance around in this circle until everybody knows, and then we're all going to go there, but it's for the purpose of transmitting information. Ritualized behavior. And he says there are remarkably extensive parallels between these processes in the phylogenetic and cultural fields. Remarkable parallels between the way animals use ritual and the way humans use ritual. Communication, channeling of certain behavior patterns into specific areas, for example, channeling aggressive behavior. So we have our sports events where we channel our aggressive behavior. We have our war games that we play with other countries so that they know and we know how important these things are and how good we are at them and how advanced we are. And we have marriage ceremonies which let everybody know that this means whatever it's supposed to mean, even if it doesn't mean that. And and everything, I mean, this academic situation, this me going through the motions and Vladimir going the motions of summarizing information for you is a kind of ritual behavior that is undertaken in Western society, especially. We can all live perfectly well without it. Without it, we can all live perfectly well. With it. It's not essential to our survival. It could be used.
Yeah.
How many university classes have you sat through which did not contribute to your survival? I mean, we require young people to go through this process for the sake of entering into society. Not that they're going to necessarily learn anything especially useful.
So 100 galleries, fine. That's all we really need.
Now, 4 years ago, I was very astonished when I was back in Europe to see the young people playing this game, who was on middle age or to build a society in middle age, or big games in the computers to play the societies and how to handle them. And they're quite fixed with this. And they do it for a long time.
So going to the priest every Sunday and hearing the same message over and over again for generations, you know, this is ritual behavior. But also sitting in front of the television watching the soccer game in the bar with your friends is ritual behavior. And these are behavior patterns that reinforce our social, cultural stability. If there was not a certain invariance in these things, people would fight with each other.
But they fight with each other.
More than they do. Or they would be less satisfied with their meager incomes. So the capitalist society can reinforce these rituals in order for people to be satisfied with a level of sustenance that is far below a certain portion of the population's level of sustenance, who have much more expensive rituals. They sail their yachts to Morocco, and they walk around in suits in front of slot machines. And that's their ritual, you know, while the average guy goes to the bar and watches the soccer match. Let's just end with this one. From the superficial convention of manners, like driving on the right side of the road, unknown in some cultures, to the underlying substance of ethical attitudes and convictions, social conduct bears the mark of the age. We're not in the bullock cart age anymore, guys. And the spirit of that age imposes on man's innate program of social conduct a pressure that increases with the development of the culture in which he lives. Why? Because the morphogenetic structures don't change as fast as the culturally transmitted behaviors do. And the more developed these culturally transmitted behaviors become, the more difficult it is for the common behaviors to adjust to them. One of the reasons why high cultures suddenly collapse may be that a revolt breaks out against a situation in which a culture that is becoming more and more ritualized, more and more sophisticated, imposes a degree of constraint on the lower vital and physical, which is felt to be increasingly intolerable. A revolt diagnosed as a decay of morals. This is biological history.
Diagnosed by whom?
By historians. It may also be diagnosed as a leap forward for some, for the few, for the elite. But the elite may see that it's no longer viable the way it is, and so that decay of morals may be a necessity for a recycling of higher values. So there are many ways to look at this, but what Conrad Lorenz has done, this is a summary of a whole book, this book, is given us a scientific picture of the evolution of behavior structures which are rooted in the cells, but which have emerged in highly sophisticated human behavior patterns in the past 5,000 years or so. And we have subsequently overpopulated the planet, and our survival is at issue. So we'll see what Sri Aurobindo has to say about this. The thing is that we look around us and we see the guys sitting in the bars watching the soccer match and using language as if it belonged to some other species, and we say, what the hell is happening to this world? Are there no values left in society? Right, who don't understand what they're talking about, and neither do they.
Which is immoral behavior.
but it has to come from the top. And so what an analysis of this from a spiritual point of view should show is that this drive and these leaps which have happened at every stage have to be explained by something other than the mechanism. The mechanisms can be described, but the mechanisms don't explain the leaps.